Okay, well, welcome everyone. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I see Jacob has his green shirt on. Of course, that's Sabres colors too. But hope you're enjoying the conference so far. Today is our third and final day. It's gone fast, though. But a lot going on. So today we have another big day. We're going to start off with a panel that Mark and I talked about this in the very beginning. We were very intent on having and found that we really were like perfect people for it. And that's the scouting and analytics panel. Following that, we've got two research presentations, one by Dave Cameron in the other room on pitching and injuries, pitching in the free agent market, and one in this room by John DeWan and Ben Jedlevic from Baseball Info Solutions on the defensive shift, infield shift, and how it's impacting some players. Following that, we'll have Mark Shapiro pending his flight. I haven't heard anything, so I think that looks good. And he'll do one-on-one with Ken Rosenfeld coming back today, who moderated our GM panel yesterday. And then we've got another lunch out here right in the same area, a panel in the afternoon on digital media and the web, how the media is getting their baseball information. We've got a great group for that. And then finally, we'll end today with the finals of the case competition. And that'll be from 3 to about 5. So that's what the day is. I wanted to introduce our moderator for the panel this morning. And his name is Dan Magala. And Dan has a long history in baseball, and a passion in baseball. I've been around the game for many years. He's the author of a book called Dugout Wisdom. He runs a consulting firm now called Property Consulting Group. He is a former executive, recently actually, in the San Diego Padres, and has a whole host of other credentials. So with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Also, before, I don't know when we're going to get another moment, but I just wanted to congratulate Vince, certainly for all his leadership at this conference in March. So let's give Vince a round of applause. I think when we were talking about this panel, the term scouting and analytics, you think about at the core of each of these subjects and how they come together. Really, if you find a great scout and you find someone that's working in technology that's really finding a new way to analyze this game, it's really that dream of finding that aha moment, right? Where you discover something in a player that maybe no one else sees, or when you're analyzing data and really taking a black and white look at the information you have access to. You get that adrenaline going, right? You just think, wow, I got something. I think these three people know what that feeling is all about. And I think as far as the discussion of the balance of both of those subjects, I think we couldn't have put together a better group, both for, the Sabre members in the crowd, I think as well as for the undergrad and graduate students. These are the kind of people, that you want to learn from, soak in their knowledge and really, pursue that path for yourself, right, to discover that aha moment. So I'd like to introduce immediately to my right, Joe Boehringer, wearing his old Sedona red, if I might ask, from his Arizona Diamondbacks.
I think it's orange.
Okay. Recently just joined the Chicago Cubs, and, certainly we've heard from Tom Ricketts and Shiraz Raymond the last couple of days. Clapping from a White Sox fan?
Okay.
To Joe's right, in the middle, we've got Corinne Vitola, who is leading Smart Cage, and certainly going to talk about the influence of technology and kind of the work that they're doing, really revolutionizing some of the approaches in predictive analysis at the team level. And what's fascinating about her as well, we're going to learn. It's not just at the major league level, but a lot of things that are impacting at the collegiate and amateur level as well. And to the far right, rounding out batting third, And
clean up.
Haven't done that in a long time.
You take a bag.
Exactly. Yeah. Can somebody do some statistics?
No, please not.
AJ is a career.
It's not started yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Better way to start.
All right. AJ is certainly one of the most diverse and smartest baseball people I've ever been around. He has a background both as a player, as a farm director, as an on-field manager, and now in his position as assistant general manager for the San Diego Padres. So please give a warm welcome to our I think before we dive in, Vince made reference to the book that I wrote, Dugout Wisdom, and was thinking about this presentation. And I had the opportunity to interview every living Baseball Hall of Famer on a critical moment in their life. And it was amazing to me, more than half of them, when asked that question, they made a reference to the scout that signed them. And if you think about George Brett, you have to think about Rosie Gillenhouse and the impact that Rosie had on George's career. But I wanted to start out with a story, and then I'm going to give both Joe and AJ a question, and then we're going to lead into the development of analytics as a result of that with Corinne. But Whitey Ford probably epitomizes to me one of the best examples of true scouting. Paul Critchell, probably one of the greatest scouts game has ever had, in 1946 was overseeing a camp for the New York Yankees. Of course, in those days, there was no draft. So, you had free reign of players. And Whitey classified and signed himself up as a first baseman. And he went to this camp. He wanted to be Lou Gehrig. And he knew Paul Critchell was the one that had signed Lou Gehrig. So he's there, and he got cut on the first run. Something that, I think those are those difficult decisions, but they didn't see anything in him as a first baseman. So Whitey then, because his other friend had driven the car and made it to the second cut, they asked him to just kind of stick around and throw ground balls for the guys that had made it. So there's Whitey Ford. Think about this. Spring of 1946, in senior in high school, throwing ground balls, and Paul Critchell, the scout that he wanted to get his attention, came over and said, hey kid, you have a pretty good arm. You ever pitch? And his response was, no, sir. I'm a first baseman. I'm going to be the new Lou Gehrig of the Yankees. And he's like, well, I saw you in the batter's box. Like, that ain't happening. And he said, come here. And he said, I'm going to show you how to throw a curveball. And Whitey Ford, 60 years later, said, that 15 minutes changed my life. And 6 months later, he's pitching in the World Series for the New York Yankees. All because a scout had an aha moment and saw something in him. So what I'd like to do for Joe and AJ initially, kind of, that Whitey Ford, Paul Critchell story, is just ask the question, if you guys are scouts in 1946, and you could go back, and you could bring one analytical tool to today, what would it be?
Wow, that's a good question. I think most of what gets people's attention, I think, is when you talk to the old-time scouts, when you talk to how their process is, you realize in a lot of ways people rely on their gut feel. Instead of on the moment, I think for us to be able to be in a predictive game with all the information that we have today, it's pretty remarkable to think of how players were signed, how players were viewed, how players were analyzed back in the day when information was sparse. So for me to take from what we have today and how to be more accurate in previous routines and to have reasons why. I think that one of the things, not necessarily what specific analytic I would take back in time, but I would love to go back in that time and ask people why. Like, what was it? There had to be something that they analyzed in order to predict good things. And that's what we're in the predictive business in the scouting. And our accuracy now is analyzed at an all-time level.
So for me, our approach and our process and our ability to define what it is that leads to a decision to sign a player, to trade for a player, to ultimately sign for a long-term contract, do we release them, do we trade them? I would want to take the openness and the open-minded of the people in this room, the people in our industry, take it back in time and troubleshoot it with the process that was in place then. Because I just have to believe it was something more than gut, something more than to sign players that ultimately they had so much less information than we have today. But over time, when you analyze the history of scouting, they were right too, and they did it a different way. And we have to find a way to use old-time methods and combine that with new age.
I think there's one other thing that's very interesting about that question. As far as that specific question, we talked about looking at a high school kid in a tryout camp. As much as we'd like to think, and as much as we point to things that have been done over the past 50 or 20 years regarding analytics, in a high school tryout setting, there's still very little that we know. So when there are no metrics for a high school player on a high school team. Or a Dominican players. So as much as we can slice and dice major league players in that part of the player pool, there's still a very large portion of players that are on the amateur side, the international side. We have them. And there is no baseline, there is no average for us to work off. Everything we do is based off of major league average, and some people have actually talked to Grant a little bit about this. When you talk about pitch effects or field effects or things that are wired up in people's ballparks, that doesn't necessarily help us when we're still trying to figure out which 17-year-old kid is actually playing games in the ballpark. So as far as we come with the analytics that are available in baseball to try and evaluate players, when you talk about something like that, it still is about your gut, your look that you have to scout and trying to trust your instincts. And Wade Ford is one example. I actually, one of the scouts that I was a mentor, a gentleman in the day from the Seattle Mariners, he did the same thing with Matt Manti. He's a guy who's been doing this for a long time. Manti was a shortstop as an amateur, and he liked the way he watched the game from him. And this guy goes from the forward, not on the arm. And he couldn't really hit. He said, hey, can you mind throwing the bullpen? And let me come down and see what happens. I ended up playing in the big leagues for quite a long time. It's not quite as extreme as Wade Ford, but it just goes to show you that as much as we do know now with major league players and what they actually do, it also shows just how little we still know when we get to other areas of players who are trying to look very, very different players and try to predict what they're going to be 3, 5, or 7 years from
And we're time traveling back to the present day, from 1946 back to 2012. Here in the present, AJ's a great driver. What you're doing, if you talk to people in the industry, it's really describing smart tape and really the curator of data, right? And you look out now, to solving the problems that some of the comments that they've already addressed. How do you start to then develop and identify what specific measurements using technology? Kind of walk through the process that one of these two guys picks up the phone and they do a call with a problem of this is our wish list. How does that process start?
Well, ironically, the object of the data is so exactly what we're trying to do in terms of this part is we're trying to provide some context here for the kids. And in doing so, we make a little bit of a difference that they're different sensors. So you're going to analyze the data that you have to do with the effects. And essentially, that's going to be an autopsy of some of these performance metrics. What we're trying to provide is context there for more performance and more capacity for the other players. And so each of you will really, kind of build your proprietary bridge. It's the entire, you know, the very, very round picture there that we believe that it's having that, that real context of data from a young point of the way to really some baselines, et cetera.
Yeah, to Joe's point, too, about the, obviously, the players from the Dominican example, and, you know, really starting to identify them. Is that different from your perspective of the lens of, you know, trying to focus on, you know, the long term, maybe versus just
Well, I think the way that you could look at it in a couple of different ways, but I think one of the things that, you know, when we partnered with Sport Vision, was what Sport Vision is doing, and what we're doing at the amateur level, is creating a standard picture. So, you know, regardless, even if it's a national draft, et cetera, you're going to have a very standardized kind of dialect of data compare and contrast from Dominican to Iowa. We thought that's where the value proposition really lies, in having some sort of where the scouts can essentially use that as a tool, as a bridge. You know, certainly never a replacement for that, which is something to augment. And I think there's clearly a need to have some judgment. So I think what the technology is doing with the data that we can provide a baseline.
And Joe, you and I were even talking before this session. You know, I think part of that is obviously having accessibility, you know, to data. Certainly, if you're working back to now, you know, with the Cubs, with everything that's going on, you know, from Shiraz and Tom Ricketts about the Bloomberg Sports relationship. You know, but certainly understanding like the evolution of the access to data and how that's changed over the years. What changes do you see forthcoming as well?
Well, I think, again, as we get going and starting to do some things with field effects, and I know Tom Pitts is here, and I don't want to point him out, but I prefer so that a conference with Tom, Tom basically made the, I don't know if it's really, it was kind of half the site and half the thing. It was like, oh, field effects are coming out, I can take this on my last 20 years of work and just flush it down the toilet. There's no way. I'm trying to figure out field. So, you know, as we continue to do this, the amount of data and the amount of information that's available to us trying to make evaluations, not just as a scout, but as an organization as a whole, it has increased immensely over the years. And there was a point in time early in the process, like the Moneyball was a big kind of moment that spurred that kind of broad attention to it. But there was a time where it was a competitive advantage for teams that they were interpreting the available data better than the other 29. And as teams have realized that the data is, you know, the available data that's out there, they recognize that the higher teams are going to interpret it. Now the difference between top club interpreters has really narrowed down. So everybody's struggling to find a new competitive advantage. The one new competitive advantage is finding the metric that they want to use. The other competitive advantage is to identify players with less track record. If you need 2,000 plate appearances from a comfortable last player, I can do it in 1,000, also augmenting it with scouts that I trust who have a track record of trying to identify players. That's my competitive advantage right now. So in some respects, in certain parts of the player pool, the new competitive advantage actually gets back to traditional scouts who hire the better guy. Now the question becomes, what makes a better guy? How do you identify what a better guy is? How do you develop a better gut among the staff? We have 40 scouts run around the country. We want to make sure all 40 of our scouts are on the same page with regard to some of the attributes that we believe have better predictive value for people that actually find them. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're in this for, is trying to find players that are going to help us win games and win games. And it's not about how many games you can orient, it's not about how many games you vibrate and you forward. It's about how many games in San Diego. But at the end of the day, whether it's your fans, the media, whoever it might be, that's what we judge for. That's the struggle for us right now, and I think that, you know, as we go forward, teams are really struggling. Every team in every sport, not just baseball centers, every team in every sport right now struggles with the battle of how you balance old school and new school together. And it's not the status.
follow-up, Joe, for the record, you went more games in Fort Wayne than anybody in baseball.
Which is not important.
In the big scheme of things, it's not important, but it's and I agree. I think what's interesting as a follow-up on Joe's point is we are getting a little more narrow vision when it comes to how much diversity I think different teams use analytics. And we seem to all have the same information, and now we're trying to figure out how we use them. And I don't know how the GM family yesterday, but I assume they were talking about how it impacted the decision. And that's really where kind of rubber meets the road as to when you're going to make a decision to sign a 15-year-old kid in the Dominican, whether you're trading for a young A-ball player. You know, we've gone through a lot of different trades in my career, managerial career, traded in a big trade as a player. You know, I was always fascinated with how these decisions are made and what went into those decisions. And so the balance, I think, in finding in different organizations, when we call around and talk to our colleagues and get engaged in these conversations, is you find out which teams, you know, where they rank different things in which they're factoring in their decisions. So some teams you go across the board and you guys will be able to name them more than I would, are strictly bottom line. You are going to have to see track record of amateur performance, minor league performance, even some early major league performance for them to consider. You have other teams that are definitely polar the opposite. It's the old time scout, it's the gut feel, it's the he needs to be 6'3", he needs to go 9'5" before I acquire him. Then you have Olivia teams in the middle that can kind of come and go depending on convenience on when they're making that decision. So for me, I think the perspective from a player to a manager to a front office executive is trying to find the perfect blend and be predictive when you're going to take that risk. And we go through trades all the time. And we go through, trading in Arizona, we traded for Dan Heron, traded six guys in order to get him. And that's met with certain criteria, certain risks. And you go into the different trades that we've made in San Diego in recent months, whether it's the Carlos Quinton trade for 2 40-man pitchers and Matt Latos trade for 4 bona fide major league contributors pretty soon. Not every decision has to be defined by the same criteria. And sometimes you're willing to take a little bit more risk, sometimes you're willing to, is that third player, is he a shoot the moon type of guy that has a high strikeout rate, or is he your A-ball performer? Because ultimately what we're trying to do is not only define what he's doing, but how he does it. And to me, that's what scouting is in a traditional way, defining how he does it. We can all see what he does by his track record of performance dating back as long as we've seen the player. Sometimes short, as we talked about, sometimes they have a long track record. But we do have to find out how much we want to factor the analytics and the scouting opinion into the actual decision.
Yeah, and AJ, if I can stay on that note, what do you do then when half the staff is really dialed in and the other's not?
Well, I would tell you, there's nothing quite like walking, and my first job in baseball after playing was a farm director. 31 years old, I believe, and walk into and sit in front of a group of 50 coaches and tell you that we're going to do things a new way, we're going to change our philosophy a little bit. That goes over pretty well. And here's this young kid that's going to come out and tell them how we're going to coach these kids up a little bit and shift their thinking. Take that a little further and say, now you're a development guy. In baseball, sometimes you're a development guy or you're a scouting guy. And Joe and I both have history in both. And I've never quite understood why you've got to put me in one bucket or the other. We've got vast experience in both. And it's okay to think in different ways. You go into a scouting group, whether it's amateur side or professional side, and you've got, I looked out this year, we had 12 or 13 pro scouts that came in town. We have them all in a big room in Peoria. We're going to rally the troops. We're going to go out and watch our workouts, and in the morning we're gonna sit there and I see 1 year experience, 2 year experience, 20 year experience, 30 year experience, and I'm supposed to blend this together for one way of doing it. You try telling a scout that you've been doing it 20, 30 years a certain way that you've all of a sudden have to type in a computer and and fill in a scouting report. He wanted to balance performance with, you know, the tools and skills. And I think that's something that's always a trick for us. And then factor that in. So a brand new scout, you're hiring, 28, 29, 30 years old, maybe have a little bit of a history of baseball playing background. He's come out of Double A or Triple A. Now you're going to teach him the ropes of scouting. Which way do you want to go? Do you want his opinion to be based on modern day analytics? Do you want him to be just tell me what you see? I think that's a difficult question to answer, because ultimately what we want is we want that scout's opinion. He needs to get to his opinion in a certain way that he's comfortable and confident that he's going to be accurate. And it's a tough balance. You know, I don't need a scouting report with a summary that is completely analytical. I don't need a scouting report that is completely like, he's going to be a major league all-star. Why? Because I said so. And that doesn't really work anymore. So I think we have to blend the two and be very careful when you're developing a pro scouting department not to polarize your department one way or the other, but know your staff well enough to know what perspective they're coming from. In other words, so that you as a leader of them, and then ultimately as filter to the family, you're able to deliver that information to him a little bit better. I know the scouts that I have that, you bring up, fancy terms and they're going to give you the stink eye, right? And I also know the guys that I try to tell them, like, no, don't look down on your paper, look at the player. You got to describe what the player is and what you see, because you're the only one in the ballpark. Don't recite what he's done. I can look that up just as well as you can. Tell me what you see and tell me how he does it. Like that's a tool that I know around baseball you're trying to balance.
Yeah, and Joe, I mean, from a statistical analysis, how does stats and data ultimately augment, then what AJ's talking about, which is ultimately the evaluation process?
Well, I think, first of all, and I do agree 100% with what AJ said, and talk about the challenge, and it is a challenge, and it is tricky to kind of have different voices on staff, but in reality, that's what we want. We don't want groupthink. We don't want one specific type of scout. We want somebody who knows pitching, and we want somebody who knows hitting, or feels more comfortable with pitching. We want somebody who feels more comfortable with hitting. We want somebody who feels more comfortable with stats. We want somebody who feels more comfortable with the scouting instinct. And at the end of it, we are trying to balance all those things. And I think what you're talking about, and the AJ's heard this a million times, and to give credit where credit is due, Jerry DeFilippo probably came up with the best analogy of it. He called it a seesaw. And it's a weighted scale. On one end is your pure information, your pure data. The example I always use is I can send my grandmother into a ballpark for 5 days and she can tell me that Albert Pujols is good. I don't need to, and Jerry obviously thought he was good with the game of but the information can tell 90-95% of the story on Albert Pujols. And that's one end of your seesaw, one end of your scale. The other end of your scale is your pure instinct scouting. It's the 15-year-old kid in the Dominican Republic who's got, his cousin's shoes that are two sizes too big. He's got the newspaper stuffed into the toes. He's running the 60-yard dash, and you're trying to figure out exactly what you have. And as a scout, and what we try and talk about as a group, is we want scouts, or we want evaluators, or we want an organization that's flexible enough to decide where we're supposed to stand on that seesaw, because where we stand on that seesaw varies for each player. For Albert Pujols, I'm going to stand all the way on one end, and I'm going to use the information, and it's going to tell 95% of my story. And when I'm in the Dominican Republic, or when I'm looking at a high school kid in the backwoods somewhere, now I'm standing all the way on the other end of the seesaw, or the other end of the scale. And now it's about the information. It's about, and I always laugh at the good face. And people talk about, the good face, ha, ha, ha. But that doesn't mean that I look at a kid's face and just tell whether or not he can play. But there are certain things, like AJ said, it's about how the player looks. How does he move? How does he throw? How does he swing? How does he run? Because there are certain checkpoints, the way big leaguers do it. When you get to the other end of that scale, how they do it and the way they do it is what's most important, because that's the best predictive tool, as poor as it is, that's the best predictive tool we have at that end of the spectrum. And when, as I move up through the ranks, if I get into high A or double A, and I'm watching a double A player, now he's got 2,000 plate appearances, or he's got 500 or 600 innings under his belt. Now I can start to maybe get some, I still care about how he looks, how he throws, how the arm works for a pitcher, how the swing works for a hitter, but now I also have this data that can give me some ideas as about walk rate and strikeout rate, controlling the strike zone. Does he have success stealing bases? Things that I might not be able to get in a 3 or 5 game look, but now I've got all this track record to help me make my call. So what we try and train our scouts to do, and what I try to do as a scout, is every single player that I see, if I just sit back and let the player talk to me through what I see and what his history tells me, he tells me exactly where I should stand on that seesaw to help make my call on that player. And our challenge as a department, as an organization, is to have all our scouts feel comfortable enough and versatile enough that they can work in different parts of the seesaw. So when we talk about the balance, there is no specific one balance point. The player and the variables that are involved in that player and the attributes I have to try and identify, they tell me where I need to stand on that seesaw. My job as a scout is to understand the seesaw exists and feel comfortable enough to move in different parts of that seesaw depending on where the player tells me to stand.
Yeah, no, I was going to follow up with it just to the Pujols example is you can also go to a high school and I remember going to see Justin Upton when he's in high school. Like, it didn't take a rocket scientist there either to tell you that he was the best player on the field. Now, what gets complicated, I think, in our business is not only do you have a predictive nature of what he's going to be. We want to know what is he going to be. You also have an investment side that we have to factor in as to whether that's salary, signing bonus, salary, player acquisition costs, timeline. Like, think that factor into decisions that we have to also have to use to decide what the heck do we do with this information that we have. We have to make sure that everything matches. And so we can have all the great information that we want. We can have all the grades of the tools and the look in the eye and all the things that we're looking for. And then there's this little thing over here that's called the acquisition cost, be it signing bonus or inventory. And that can change everything. Because it's about accessibility to that player as well in order to add them to your organization. And so where we rank these players as they get across baseball, there's no one singular way to are you focused on age? Are you focused on position? Are you focused on physique? Are you focused on stuff? I mean, our job as scouts is to break all that down and then build them back up to where we can make a decision on what we do with all the information. In today's world, we have so much more information available to us. And what you're finding across baseball is people are open to making decisions based on different criteria. And that's why the organizations are run differently.
Yeah, I think I've got a question for Corinne related to that. But I know, one of the things about the panel, today and talking especially a lot to the case competition students, I'm gonna turn it over for questions from the audience. So start thinking about some questions. I know we've got some eager students that definitely want to learn from the panel. But Corinne, we got a great lens of what these two guys go through on a daily basis of just the challenge, right, of so much data. Joe said earlier, we're just looking for different metrics, all the time that can give us a competitive advantage. And I think when you and I were talking, just because you can measure something, what's the right one to focus on and the path of, I think we're always talking about that aha moment. Kind of walk again through that process of determining which metrics to focus on and how to understand what maybe the right elements to measure are versus maybe the ones that are ineffective.
Well, I think we're all going to learn that together. And frankly, every organization has a different focus, right? My mantra to my engineering team is just because we can measure something doesn't mean we should. frankly, we are inundating everybody with just volumes of data, and I think the challenge for all of us here is, of course, to really understand what to weight and what to make meaningful in helping each organization make these decisions. Frankly, so far, I can't say that I've seen
a real common denominator. I think, you know, every organization is really aiming for that competitive advantage and is trying to come up with everybody's secret sauce, if you will, and is weighting at each of these metrics differently. You know, for instance, I mean, we're putting out 50 metrics on every player. AJ, you're gonna weight that differently than Joe. I think now we're really kind of at the dawn of how all of these things are going to impact, and I think it's going to take a while to really understand what will eventually prove to be meaningful. I mean, of course, there are the obvious ones, you know, the real basics. But again, some of the more granular data, and exactly, you know, I'm absolutely heartened to, you know, and empathize with the points here. It's very easy to get lost in data, right? And what we don't want to happen is have some of our information points, give you second-guess situations, right? What we want to be able to do is fortify those decisions to really reinforce what the innate, you know, marry that with the innate things that you're seeing, you know, from the human condition. So I, quite frankly, I'm not sure that there's a really succinct answer to that. I think we're all going to find that collectively as it goes.
Can I open it up? Any questions? Gentleman right here in the front. Start and wait for the microphone if you can, so everybody can.
I wanted to build a little bit on the Whitey Ford anecdote, but bring it forward to the 2000s. When you're dealing with an amateur player who is or thinks he is a two-way player, I'll give you a couple of names you can sort of think about. Joe Savory, for example, or Aaron Hicks coming out of high school, or Anthony Ghost coming out of high school, Casey Kelly coming out of high school. When these guys present themselves either as two-way players or have a particular preference of what to play, how do you approach that player and his agent? And how do you apply standards to try to explain your position on how that player should be developed and go forward as a professional?
You know, first, and, you know, it's interesting. You bring up a lot of good names, and you do it strategically, let's say. In order, you know, I think with the amounts of relationships that are built, amateur scouts that are in there, they're called area scouts, and they're in charge of their area. Some greater than others, but depending on the amount of players that are in the, you know, the LA-based guy is just going to have LA. We have a guy in Southern California, et cetera, et cetera. So that man develops a rapport with the family for years, and ultimately you rely on that relationship to get information into that family, into that player. So it's not just somebody coming over the top and telling you this is how you're going to live your life and this is what you're going to do. But we ultimately have to make a stance as to where we feel his strengths are utilized the most compared to major league projection. And sometimes in Casey Kelly's example, in a different organization in Boston, they allowed him to go out as a position player, play shortstop for half the season, then he pitched the second half of the season. I can't remember what his batting average was, but his performance was not, was very good. He actually went to the Fall League as a position player, and again had struggles, and kind of led him to failure in order to convince him that position was his strengths. But I think there's two ways that you want the kid in your organization, and there's strong debates in draft rooms as to whether or not Aaron Hicks would have been a better pitcher because he was in the mid 90s, or is he a better outfielder? But developing an honest development plan, presenting that to the family, to the player, his representation, and then ultimately it's up to your scouts and your general manager, assistant general manager, your farm director, in selling that plan to the player, and always paying attention to where the future stands for that kid, because ultimately a lot of these kids have never failed when you get them out of draft. And until they get into pro ball and they look over, I mean, Justin Upton, as an example, I'll give you, when Joe and I were in Arizona, came out and was a shortstop. I'm going to be a shortstop. I want to be a shortstop. I'm going to sign as the number one overall pick as a shortstop. he walked into his first big league camp and saw Stephen Drew and was like, I can't do that. It took that for him to say, okay, I'm okay. And now he's a right fielder. And you look at him, you know, body projection wise, no way he's going to stay a shortstop just by the eye. So sometimes they just have to be led to an example to further your point. But your scouts are paid to make a call. Do you like him as a position player? Do you like him? Sometimes they're right down the middle. You'll have an area guy who likes him as a pitcher. You'll have a cross checker that likes him as a position player. I think ultimately for mine, and turn over to Joe, is like, I just want to know, is he a big leaguer? Because if he's a big leaguer, how is he going to be a big leaguer? And if that's the case, then let's put him in that path and get him to the big leagues.
I would agree with that. I think one of the things is baseball is littered with players like that. I was with the Los Angeles Dodgers at one point. We drafted Coy Hill in the fourth round as a third baseman out of Wichita State with the intention of making him a catcher because that's his tool set matched up better with the catching position than the third baseman. That was our scouting call. We drafted Edwin Jackson, who was an outfielder who was the third pitcher on his high school team. And there was another pitcher on his high school team that got draft attention, and we had our cross-checker lived in Columbus, Georgia, which is where Edwin's from, knew the family. Our cross-checker's wife was a teacher of Edwin's, and he was coming up through school. So we knew that, you know, we drafted him, and he did the same thing. He DH'd in the rookie league and threw bullpens and pitched. And the next thing you know, as on his 20th birthday, he's beating Randy Johnson in the big leagues. You know, so it does become a challenge. The one thing I will say is that it's a very delicate process because you do have to get the player to buy in to whatever direction you're going to try and go. Because if the player doesn't buy in the back of his mind, if he's always got it, what we are looking to do is extremely hard. Make no mistake about it. If there are 30 teams in the big leagues, there are 25 active players on each roster, and we get them from all over the world, these are the best 750 people in the world at their job. They are all wired a certain way, and they all have a certain skill set that is required for them to play at that level. And when you have a player who does have maybe multiple options at a certain stage in his career, he does need to buy into it. And it does need to be a group process, because if that player doesn't buy into it, it's awful hard to be one of the 750 on talent alone.
As a follow-up, would you use some of the smart cage standards or data to try to make that sale?
Possibly, but if the kid tells me he doesn't want to do it, then he doesn't want to do it. Yeah. And then I need to make the call. Well, you know what? We like him as a pitcher. I don't know how this is going to work out, but there was a player named Brett Eibner drafted a couple years ago by the Oakland A's. Kansas City Royals. And he pitched and played the outfield. And he was the classic guy. Half of them liked him as a pitcher, half the teams liked him as a position player. He wanted to go out and hit. And so what that does is that half the teams that really like him as a pitcher need to go out. You know what? In looking for tiebreakers, I have these two players that I value kind of equally. One of them wants to do it and the other one doesn't. So we'll go in a different direction. He's got his chance to go out and hit. We'll see how it works out for him. But he's the classic guy. You know, Brooks Kieschnick was another guy. He ended up doing both in the big leagues. Yeah. Micah Owens, who we had in Arizona, you know, has done both. Bogusevic, is that the kid? Mm-hmm. Houston, you know, had a career, and all of a sudden. Jason Lane, Adam Lowen, you know, so they're out there. It's awful hard to do it that way.
Matt Bush.
You know what's interesting about those type of scenarios, and a key component of that is the timing. Like, when do you actually make them focus on something? And because you can kind of do anything in low A ball and rookie ball, and you start to climb the ladder, it gets more and more specialized. But more times than not, you're talking the player into pitching, and you're talking him into pitching because he can't hit, right? And that's a tough sell when you tell. I mean, sometimes they have to be shown, but you know, because we had a couple of kids in the past that, you know, we had a kid named Layson Stephanoff in Arizona who was a left-handed pitcher. He turned into a left-handed pitcher, but you go out and the scouts go out and watch him and they're going to put top of the scale 80 throw tool on him.
And he had a funky swing. He had a lot of different actions. He was a really energetic guy. He just kept playing just good enough to where he didn't want to buy in. And we went to talk to him about changing positions and going to go be a pitcher. And Tony Pena was the same way. Most of these kids are scared to death they're going to get hurt. Because if he loses his arm, he's been told his whole life he can really throw, he can really throw, he can really throw. We turn him into a pitcher and blow him out. And now what does he have to hang his hat on? But that you never really have to talk anybody into going to hit. They all want to go hit. You have to talk them into going to pitch because they don't believe they can't hit. And that's the tough sell that you've got to find a way to get the player buy-in, as Joe said, because until Tony Pena, as an example, ended up making the big leagues as a pitcher, and ultimately has I can see his Tommy John this year, he has to want to do it in order to maximize his potential. And you do that, very rarely you're going to hear the stories that Jason Lane is an example that kind of runs the gamut. Rick Ankiel,
yeah,
ran the gamut. And gets to the big leagues and then all of a sudden reinvents himself and does it again. Those are exceptions to the rule. More times than not, an A-ball, you're trying to say, hey, kid, you can't hit, why don't you go pitch? And that's, I can say a little more blunt in this room than I could in an office.
You know, I'm actually, I think one of the most historical examples of seeing the gentleman with his Gary Carter jersey. You look at Gary Carter, I mean, drafted as a shortstop, first year in the big leagues, plays left field, and then gets switched to catcher. When I interviewed him for the book, I mean, certainly when you think of historically ball players with the most positive attitudes of all time, he'd be in the conversation. And he just continually said when scouts suggested different positions for him, hey, my goal is to be a big leaguer. You guys are paid to make these decisions. Yes, sir. Certainly a dream for the folks up here, to have that kind of attitude. But, I think that there's lessons there. What are they trying to accomplish?
Yeah, unfortunately, today's players are born like this why generation, want to ask questions on everything, like why. But on the catching example, you need to be pretty tough to be a catcher.
Yeah.
So, that's
the
way I go.
I think the other thing is catching is the one position, and AJ actually did it at the big league level, but catching is the one position that's most difficult for us to scout, because catchers in the big leagues don't come from the catching ranks as amateurs. Henry Blanco is a converted third baseman. Victor Martinez is a converted infielder. Carlos Santana with the Indians, converted infielder. They don't come from catching, because in the catching ranks, at least in the U.S. amateur market, we take the fattest, slowest, dumpiest kid, throw the gear on him, put him behind the plate. Smeltest, most athletic, flexible kid, put mine. But in most cases, we do a bad job in the amateur game of putting the tool set that plays a catcher in the big leagues. We usually don't see that behind the plate at the amateur level. Usually that player's playing somewhere else on the diamond. So for us, it's a lot of times catching comes from other spots. We all hear about in the draft, oh, as soon as the first catcher goes off the board, boom, everybody's going to go, boom, 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 boom. Well, you know what? If you look at the pool of big league catchers right now, a lot of them did not catch as amateurs. So that makes it even tougher for us. And I tip my cap to Logan White for the Dodgers. With the Dodgers, I don't know if he's still doing this, but he actually every year would ask his guy, who's the one guy in your area that's a conversion candidate for catching?
Right.
Because that's where catchers come from, and they're hard to find.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all your points except for the fat nothing part. But it's interesting to again why we convert those guys. So they're probably agile enough. They have an arm and they can hit. We got to find a place for their bat. And again, not to make this all about the bat, but that's a position to where if he can play at a major league average level defensively and can bring offense, that's a huge competitive advantage. And so that's ultimately the part, even if he is less athletic than some.
And is that your cerebral in there too?
There's a little cerebral part. You have to be tough, you have to be smart, be in shape.
Yeah. You know, it's from this perspective, it was amazing. You know, we could see the audience when that comment was made. I watched a lot of the students like write down, probably like imagining like must come up with system to measure potential catchers, right?
We've got that.
We've got a question up here, and then the lady there, if we can get the microphone.
Hi,
to this gentleman up front. And then we'll go to the, yep.
John, you were talking about the seesaw effect. In terms of strategy for the future, for future scouts, do you still anticipate that the old-time ball players and the old-time scouts will continue to scout and the analytics? I'm talking more specifically about the kids that are coming out through the minors,
right,
for which you have data. Will you the scouts will continue to scout, and then at your level or another level, the analytics will come into play, or do you expect your scouts to get somewhat expert on the analytics?
I would actually say both. Ideally, what you'd like is you have people that are going to be more comfortable in the scouting arena, you have people that are going to be more comfortable in the analytics arena, and you're hoping that you have enough people in your organization that are conversant in both areas so that as a group you can make the best decision for your organization. So, we understand that people are going to feel more comfortable or have strengths in different parts of the seesaw. It's our job to make sure that we have the right scout in the right ballpark seeing the right player. So the scout that we feel best can make the evaluation on the player, that's who we want. And if it's one scout who can handle both of those things, the analytics and the scouting, and make a comfortable call, that's okay. But we're also going to augment it with maybe a second look from somebody who's not as comfortable in in the analysis part. And we'll also be running our analysis separately for somebody who's probably never even saw the player play.
So, will you look for in your higher criteria then? Will you look for analytics?
I think that as I mentioned before, I want a scouting group that is not homogenous. I want one that has varied skills. I fully expect to have some people on staff that are more comfortable than others in certain arenas. I fully expect we'll have someone who's dedicated solely to analytics, and I fully expect that I'm going to have a scout on staff who's been doing it longer than I've been breathing oxygen. And you know what? If all he wants to do is go out and tell me what the player does and how he does it, I'm okay with that. Because it's my job and it's our job as an organization to merge all those things. I want experts in all those different areas. So I can sit here and talk. I want versatility, but I also want to make sure that we're as thorough as we can be in all areas of trying to evaluate a player. So, I don't know if that answers your question entirely, but that's the philosophy behind it.
Thank you.
Yeah, can you talk about evaluating the scouts themselves and the potential role of analytics there?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously have criteria. Easiest criteria is if they're right. And ultimately, that takes time. And what's difficult in our sport now is there are a lot of transitions going on around the sport, and so there are a lot of different people with different backgrounds and have worked for different teams. And the age of being a scout for 20, 30 years in the same organization is kind of like being a player for 20 or 30 years in the same organization. Like, it just doesn't happen as much anymore. There are relationships that are built. So you have a lot of people, a lot of moving parts. And so sometimes you find out whether the scouter is right or wrong and he's working for somebody else. And that's not a good feeling when he's right. But, I think we have a long history of reports. And the way we have it done is, we assign teams to each individual scout. They write a collection of, 25 reports per team, one per player. And then we have that stored. And we have it at a touch of a button. We've got it accessible to us. And over time, what you find out is where their strengths are, where their what catches their eye, what catches their attention, how much they do balance, tools and performance, and so we certainly track it. And when it fits into, it's easy to say, to go out and see the top-notch players and say, I like that guy; he's going to be a big leader. We all like Bryce Harper. We can all write a report in this room and say yes. And it's not necessarily about having the guy that has the one guy on his resume that really liked David Eckstein. He goes on and has a 10-year career when everybody in the whole industry, he's short, he doesn't have any power, he can't hit, and just happened to be a World Series MVP. That guy on his resume is good, but he's got to continue to do it and have an evolution of thought to to contribute to the decisions that are being made at the highest level. So we do track it. We do have a an idea. You know, I've got scouts that they go into A-ball, go into and have 20 major league average grades on a particular A-ball team. I'll be the first to go like that doesn't really work. And just the law of averages is going to tell you you're not going to have 20 big leaguers in one league, let alone one team. So that's an extreme example, but we do monitor, we do track it. What I've found is and to follow up on a different point, is that eventually they're all going to have been exposed to analytics from the origination of their scouting tenure. And that's what's going to be interesting over time, is we're able to track how much people really believe in the statistical analysis and how much they factor it in the evolution of the scouting career. Because now, you know, the old-time scouts that have never have been held to a standard of being right and being cross-checked by statistics are now being viewed in a whole new arena as being successful or not.
I would agree with that. Now, if there's another question.
Yep. I think right here, and then if we can get the microphone to this gentleman for the next question.
Well, this is actually addressed to all of you. It has to do with the idea of, particularly with amateur prospects, I have to wonder, in terms of scouting, when scouts are looking for tools, you hear about the different tools, five tool players, etc., but it seems to me like there are subtleties specifically related to what you see as coachable versus what you would see as inherent. I mean, for instance, something like fear of the plate, I don't think you can coach that out of a guy. Similarly, something like, you know, having a good eye. You know, I'm not sure you can coach a guy into having a good eye, or maybe you can coach him into having quick hands. I could see, for instance, you know, arm strength being something that you could train someone with, but maybe not accuracy in terms of throwing. And I'm wondering how that affects scouting if they take into account, you know, we can improve on this. You see, for instance, big leaguers where they start, I mean, Robinson Cano is a good example where, you know, he wasn't a great hitter and now he was like won the home run derby. And it takes a few years to develop and you can do that in the big leagues. But, you know, part of that is that you start out with a good eye at the plate and you have an high OVP and things like that. So.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. I think one thing to keep in mind is players do get better. We're in the projection business. They all get better. And our job is to find out how much better they're going to get in particular areas that impact the major league game. Just because they can increase their arm strength, does that really impact the major league game? Or can they increase their, or improve their approach and maybe refine the strike zone? Of course they can. But does it apply that to major league average, and is that going to impact the major league game? So over time, I mean, that's kind of what we do, is try to project, you know, how much better they're going to get. You take, there's some kids that are in high school that are gifted, and you know, we had Austin Hedges last year as a catcher to evaluate catchers. You go out and watch Austin Hedges catch in high school to a man, everybody would say it's one of the best catching prospects we've seen. Like his defensive readiness exceeds. Like he's going to get a little bit better, but it's not. I mean, kind of a, you know, like the guy who throws 100 in high school, Giolito, this year at Harvard Westlake until he blew out. Like it's hard to project even better, right? He already throws 100. I'm not sure he's going to throw 104. But so there's a, you know, there's certain projections that get made, and guys are going to get a little bit better. They're going to get more mature. They're going to get stronger. They're going to get more efficient. But don't forget that analysis of how is that going to impact the major league game. That's the bottom line. And our job to determine that and then put a value on that with whether given the organization.
I think the other part of that is we spend a lot of time asking the question of why. So if I say, you know, hey, this is a below average curveball, and eventually one day he's going to have an above average curveball. And now I need to answer the question why. Because when we see amateur kids or even minor league players, they are not finished products. We're trying to guess what they're going to look like as finished products. And the challenge becomes having some sort of rationale behind why you make your decision. And a lot of times the main ways that a player gets better, either A, he physically gets stronger, B, he does something different mechanically that allows him to be more efficient or be more productive, or the third thing is a change in approach in the way they go about the way they play. Those are really the three main, there's subtle ways too, but those are the three main areas. So if I have a a college pitcher who's right-handed and he's 22 years old and he's 5'10" and he's 195 pounds and he's built like a beer keg, and his everything kind of works okay as far as the arm and the body, and he throws 88 to 90, he's pretty much always going to throw 88 to 90. But if I've got the high school kid who doesn't have a good delivery and doesn't know how to leverage his body to maximize his strength, and he's not physically filled out yet, and he's skinny, scrawny, and everything's loose and works very easily, he does it in a very easy fashion physically, and he throws 88 to 90, well, that one I can go, hey, you know what, this guy might throw 90 to 94 one day. But there's a basis behind that. I'm just not running out there and going projecting on every single guy and the same amount of projection. Some guys I might project a little, some guys I might project a lot, some guys I might project backwards. Because if I see a player who's a college player who's 22 years old, that's thick and looks like he's gonna get heavier as he ages, and he's a below average runner right now, well, if it takes him, the average college player takes, you know, a little under 4 years to get there, a little under 4 years from now, he's no longer going to be a 40 runner. He's going to be a 30 runner or a 20 runner, so I may actually project backwards on certain tools depending on the player that I'm looking at. So when you talk about the projection, the secondary question is always why, and you need to have some sort of answer as to why you're making that call as an evaluator.
It's another subtle, like, dig at catchers of our aggressive. But one thing, just one quick thing, to talk about the timelines, the amateur scouts see the rawness of the tools, they hand them to player development, they maximize to their greatest ability, whatever that kid's maximum ability is. Our pro scouting department go out and analyze where does that player fit in the universe of players. And it's a kind of a hand the baton to the next group. And then we analyze it in a big group of players, and then at the major league level, kind of what does that mean and how can that impact the major league game? So you can kind of see a progression of analysis as it goes across, and you get way more information the closer you get across the board to the big leagues.
My question's for Corinne. Tying together two things you said earlier. One is you talked about collecting 50 metrics on these young players. And then the second is when Dan was talking about next generation of kids trying to study, identify the next set of major league catchers, you said you're doing that already. I was hoping you would go on and elaborate on which of the 50 metrics you thought you were collecting would apply specifically to identifying future catchers, and maybe anything else that is germane to
Certainly. What
you're already doing
Certainly.
In that area.
What we've done is we've created kind of a sensorized batter's box so we can break down into really specific increments, you know, the foot quickness, the glove to release times, et cetera. Some of those things, I mean, everybody's going to have a different indicator, right? I don't think there is, I mean, from our perspective, Tom, what we are doing is we're just providing the data. We're not really prescribing, you know, what's valuable or what's an indicator. That's really, you know, for you all to decide there. But I mean, we're seeing some real correlations, certainly. And it's, you know, I would say in general, it's mostly general agility, it's quickness. You know, as you had said, AJ, the strength aspect of it, I mean, that's all going to come into play very differently, depending on who's looking at it. So, I mean, what we're doing is just essentially providing you some of these, you know, objective metrics. And like I said, we're all really going to learn how these things kind of pull together there. And as you said, you know, measure of success there is going to be, you know, I think you can only see that in hindsight, right? I mean, we're all going for best guesses here. As much as everybody's looking for the crystal ball, I think, you know, they're all just small increments of it.
Yeah, I actually had a question for AJ. And then a gentleman back there in the orange asked the next question. You know, it was triggering a thought, you know, all this analyzation. You know, in the old days, I remember Coos Gossage telling me a story that he knew when a scout that he really wanted to, you know, charm, I guess, with his skills would be at the game, and he'd just crack. I mean, he'd get neurotic about it. And I'm wondering, you know, and then actually when he eventually did get signed, there was a scout that he didn't know was there and, you know, pitched a perfect game. And you know, you forget this is a 17, 18-year-old kid. It's human nature, right? But I'm curious from your perspective, you know, maybe even the lens from a manager, now in modern times, it's really, you know, instead of the scout, it's how it's going to impact their stats and their analytics, and they're very aware, right, that people are analyzing glove, you know, ratio and everything. Does that play into the player psyche at the major league level of being aware of how they're being analyzed and how they analyze themselves?
A little bit. You know, I think it's always interesting the way that the presence of scouts has grown and people and attention to the sport has grown at various levels. Because when I grew up in Oklahoma, and when we knew kind of when scouts were there because they had the big fancy radar gun and the big straw hat, they had the look of the scout. And so they would go out and they would come and you would know. You would see them, and usually it was a sprinkle in. Midwest City, Oklahoma wasn't a hotbed until Matt Kemp was
there.
No, I mean, I used to be the best player, and then Matt Kemp came along. But another reason I hate the Dodgers from the Padres' perspective. But it was interesting as that, you know, one or two guys sprinkle in, and they got to know your father and your mother, and they shake your hand, they look you in the eye, and one of how strong your handshake was, and all the. They had the stopwatch hanging out their pocket, and they had it was interesting. Now it's grown to where you can't go to a game. There's showcases, right? Now these kids are trained to try. I mean, it happens in Dominican all the time. They're trained to try out, and they know what you're looking for. You know, I was down in Florida last week at a college game, or I'm sorry, a high school game, and it was you know, there were probably 100 of us standing there, all looking the same. I didn't go with a straw hat, but. We're looking at these kids, and so they're so used to it by now. Yeah. You can't sneak up on too many kids. And you might go in the backwoods and a kid that you know, doesn't have the internet and doesn't sure what the scout means. But nowadays, there's so much attention on these young kids at 14 years old, at 15 years old, to where, and they know what you're looking for. Like, good luck getting a kid in high school when you're at his high school game, like, take a really good BP. What's he going to do? He's going to try to launch and hit homers. Because he knows power pays. Because he's been told power pays. They try to hit home runs. You go down to the Dominican and have a workout, you know, they do not leave anything in their tank when they throw across the infield. They are throwing as hard as they possibly can to try to impress you. Velocity pays. So they know, you know, from a what is going to get them to the next level. And then what's funny is that gets them signed, and then when you put them in a game, how they play gets them promoted. And that's a difficult sale. Like, the kid that airs it out and throws 95 and gets signed, and to throw a strike, he's got to throw 90. That's a different pitcher when you're scouting. So it's a very tough balance, and even at the major league level. You know, I told you the story of Max Scherzer when I was managing, and he'd given up a couple early home runs, and so instead of sending the pitching coach out, I go out. Max, you all right? He's like, oh yeah, I mean, I've already given up, and both of my fly balls I've given up are home runs. I'm not going to give up another home run. Max, what are you talking about? So I'm just telling you, the percentage of fly balls that go out of the ballpark. I just turn around and walk back, and he's got it all figured out. So, I mean, some players are very acutely aware. And you know, I don't know, Brandon McCarthy came in here, right?
Yeah.
And he's very, very, you know, very good at understanding. I mean, we have a conversation. We tried to sign him in San Diego, and he got on the phone with him. And some care, some don't. They do know, like, ironically, at the major league level, they definitely know what pays in arbitration. So they're very aware of those statistics. How that affects the day-to-day performance or their preparation, I mean, I don't think it's as prevalent as maybe people want to believe, but they're aware. Their agents are telling them, they're telling them, their friends are telling them, somebody's got them in a fantasy league, but there's a lot of moving parts here that impact the player's, you know, brain, but because ultimately they know they have to play well and perform well to stay. That's the bottom line.
Max Scherzer, by the way, like me, suffering Missouri Tiger alum. Today, so, but smart guy, obviously, right? University of Missouri.
Yeah.
Question from the
better fastball than Brent.
Yeah. I'm coming from the coaching perspective. I coach at the Cape League every summer, and work with Kareem, and players are becoming more robotical by far because of being coached every day in a batting facility, maybe not getting metrics, but they're becoming more robotical by far. I think scouts are better than they've ever been because of combining the metrics and the old school. Howard McCall is a good friend of mine. you guys know, and Howard's about as old school, and still has a straw hat.
Howard doesn't need to, I need your eyes. I don't care if you look at the back of the baseball card piece of paper, you just go in and you just tell me what you see, and I'll figure the rest out. Don't worry about it. He's a perfect example of that. He can do whatever he wants to do in a ballpark because he knows what a player looks like.
Well, yeah, he writes on the back, we'll play in the major leagues.
That's all you need to
know. We say, okay.
That's exactly right.
I'll find the next one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But I think scouting's better than it's ever been, in my estimation, watching. My question really is, in combining all this, we don't have backyard baseball anymore. We don't have instinctive players anymore. We have robotical players. So how do you guys go about in taking all the metrics and so forth and deciding a little bit who's robotical? AJ kind of answered it a little bit while ago. You have guys that throw 95 because they know you're there. You go to a showcase, you know, they pitch great, then they go back and try to pitch every day, and they're just very average. But how do you kind of make that final decision in regards to breaking it down and who's robotical and really who's rhythmic and really their athletic ability is going to improve? That's because it's getting tougher and tougher.
Sure.
Today.
No, I think the big key in that is trying to find as many different ways to evaluate the player in different circumstances. And there's a difference between the tryout camp. You know, it's very difficult to sign a kid out of a batting practice and infield. And maybe the 60-yard depth. That's kind of what you do at a tryout, but you need to see him in a game. Like, you'll see the kid's natural rhythm, natural body movements, natural feel for the game in seeing him in game action, which is very difficult. You know, we signed a kid in Arizona, in the Dominican, out of a tryout camp, ran a great 60-yard dash. He had a nice little swing. There were dreams of Jose Reyes, and he could run, he could throw, he had this nice swing. We put him in a game, And the ground ball was hit up the middle to center field, and he took off and he kept going after the ball and ran right towards the center fielder, and you end up with the center fielder and the shortstop. So we, you know, in translation, we had our coaches like, what the heck's going on? He had never played in a game in the Dominican. He had only been in these showcases. So though that he's a good practice player, he's a terrible of a game player. Right? We learned that after the fact. Remember Sepulveda?
Yeah.
And so it's a, you know, that type of history is an extreme, but until you can see them in game action, you really don't know. There's no rhythm to batting practice, really. You know, you got a controlled environment. The guy's throwing 65 miles an hour. He's throwing it right down the middle the whole time. You've got a bullpen, underwritten, no duress, no stress, no issues. You know, our job is to find that game action. If it's in the Dominican, great. If it's in Cape Cod, like, I can watch them in practice with the wood bat, which is a great, tool for us. In the game is where I'm really going to find out about the player.
Yeah, I think the toughest job you have today is because players aren't as team-oriented because they're going to showcases. And it's not like the old Legion days of playing every day and you're trying to get to a, you know, state championship and whatever it may be, because they're not as team-oriented. And I think the scouting, like I said, I think scouts are better than ever in what they do, but I think the toughest job you guys still have is who's going to be team-oriented when they get there and who's going to be individually oriented, and that's very, very difficult.
I agree. I mean, yeah. Playing winning baseball, we talk about it. We talk about it in every room and in every stadium is the kids that play winning baseball, and again, you go back to makeup. When you're signing an amateur player, things you can't measure on paper are key components of the signing process, the makeup, because you know, the other side of that is they'll learn to answer the questionnaire exactly how you want it. Right. They'll tell you how great, they'll tell you how competitive they are, you know, until they face a good kid, and then they you know, regress like a fat catcher.
I think that's one of the things that it really rely on your area scout. That's the area scout is going to see the kid. I mean, they all run the showcase circuit. All profile kids run on the showcase circuits. They all get seen by the cross checkers and the scouting directors because they're at all the major events. But it's that area scout who sees the kid, you know, comes to the ballpark from the moment he gets to the ballpark. You know, I went and I watched the kid a couple of years ago in a St. Petersburg Junior College in Florida. And I got there, we had a brand new scout, and we got there early. And you know, we saw the kid get there with the team. We saw his mom got there early. We saw her, you know, hand him the four Gatorades and the three Clif Bars. You know, we saw the girlfriend come. We saw, so, and we kind of saw his whole routine before the game, how he went about his business, how he prepared, how he got ready, how he did his stretching, how he did his running, how focused he was. And then there were other scouts that maybe had been in another game earlier or decided, I'm going to show up like right at game time. Well, they show up and they miss all that. And they get there right at game time and they see the kid throw 94 and they write it down and they leave and go back to the office. And at the end of the day, we are identifying players and what their skills are. But like any other, you know, job recruiters, we're trying to identify people who actually have the chance to be successful. And it's up to the area scout to know the person just as well, if not better, than he knows the player. So it's easy to go to the showcase setting and just kind of cherry pick the easy times to see the players compete. But just like, and you know, area scouts will tell you this all the time. I've signed players. You are the lifelink or the lifeline for that player during the summer. They call their signing scout. The scout checks in with them. The scout gets feedback on how the kid's first summer's going until he gets comfortable with the coaching staff and the player development people. So as an area scout, almost like a parent, when you stick your neck out for a player and you sign that player and your name's attached to that player, you are vouching for that player as he goes out into the world of professional baseball and succeeds or fails. So the things that you talk about on the showcase circuit, as an industry, we can all identify those, but it really boils down to the area scout knowing the person. And that's what's going to help our success, or, you know, our hit rate, is identifying the right people.
One last thing is, the smart case we're finding out is which guys come in and compete in the smart case and which ones do the hitting and throwing everything and kind of say, this is a piece of cake. And you actually find out how competitive they are, which has been interesting.
You know, what? Another follow-up on that, what's really interesting about different ways of getting information is what Joe's talking about is exactly right. When you actually sign the player and draft the player, or what's interesting is when you trade for a player. Or you don't, if you don't draft that kid, that still goes in the file.
Yeah.
So as an example, with the Latos trade this winter, we were going through all the different names. We scoured the entire Cincinnati Reds, organization. We had information from Boxberger from SC, from Grandal and Alonzo at the University of Miami, and then back to their amateur days, and Boxberger's amateur days, Volquez from his Texas days, from the Dominican. We had information, so when you're getting this information, you're putting it in the file. It may be used for this draft, it might be used for next year, it might be used for a trade 3 years from now. And obviously things happen between now and then and people change, but the important is not only when you get that player, but when you don't, it's still in there for your ability to access it later when something may come up. You're building a file on every player every time you see him. I mean, a lot of what we do in pro scouting is never used. And it's a kind of a difficult reality of, we're going to go see thousands and thousands of players this year in the minor leagues. And we happen to have a really busy offseason with getting Quentin, getting the four with Cincinnati, getting John Baker. You might go through an offseason and not do anything. But that's okay, because you're building that file in order to when you do need the information, that it's there, not only about the makeup, but about the scouting report.
Yeah. Well, we started out, we went back in time to 1946, and I think we're 6 minutes over, right now. But I think everybody in the audience certainly appreciated the extra innings comments there, that ended it. So, we started, obviously, with the talk of, an aha moment that you want from scouting analytics. And let's give the three of these guys a round of applause.